WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. This is the Artist Experience radio program. We hope you can join us with your morning joe, your OJ, or maybe some English breakfast tea, or maybe a smoothie. We have our own smoothie, too, at WOWD, and that's Bobby Hill, and he'll be up at the 10 o'clock hour, so stay tuned to his wonderful program. We want to be the cream cheese schmear on your bagel, the jelly on your English muffin, the butter on your toast. We want to be the blueberries on your scone and maybe the chocolate in your croissant. And we hope we can get you juiced about talking about art. You are tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park. It is 94.3 on your FM station. And this is your community radio station. And we hope you're enjoying us on the airways. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show. We hope you've enjoyed our previous programming.
Hi. The Artist Experience is an hour radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help the viewer, when they visit the exhibit, create in their soul, in their experience, their own work of art. We also have an Artist Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we've been talking about. It's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. Please look at it while you're listening if you can. You can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, so that you can listen at any time. We at WOWDLP Tacoma Park are always looking to improve our community radio station.
Well, today we have a very intense show, and I've titled the show, Can You Top This? Vermeer and the Other Masters of Dutch Genre Painting. Whenever you talk about Johan Vermeer, the great Dutch painter who lived from 1632 to 1675, he conjures up things of great beauty, virtuosity, poetry, mystery, sensuality, and sexuality. That's a lot to say for an artist that we don't know really that much about. And he, having only painted between 34 and 40 paintings attributed to him in his very short life. The blockbuster and crowd-pleasing exhibition is titled Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting. It is at the National Gallery of Art in the West Wing, and it's ongoing until January 21st, 2018. It's on view concurrently with a Dutch drawing exhibition that we talked about in a previous program a few weeks ago. Why do I predict this show will be so intense, Sheila? Come on, let's hear it. My dear co-host gets very intense when she talks about Vermeer. She kind of hyperventilates, right? And when
sure.
You see a Vermeer painting. But let's go back away, Sheila, to 1995 to 1996. Again, at the National Gallery of Art with an overtop blockbuster exhibition about Johan Vermeer. Remember that, Sheila? Let's go down art memory lane and share a little with our listeners about Vermeer's genius.
Yeah, because we didn't even know each other then. But when the Vermeer show opened at the National Gallery, there were two catastrophes, like the perfect storm.
Right.
The district government had completely run out of money and it shut down. There were no government services. You don't know what that means. It means nobody cleaned the streets. There's no garbage collection. You couldn't go to the motor vehicle bureaus. There were no snow plows. And then the biggest blizzard of the decade. They had to call in the National Guard to clear the streets. And meanwhile, locked up in the museum for 2 weeks were these masterpieces, and nobody could see them. So luckily, I had a friend who worked there, and she took me into the darkened museum, and I got a private tour. It was a very weird experience.
You know, I remember that exhibition well. I had just moved to the district. The line was out the door, and I waited in zero temperature cold to get in. Well, I froze my Vermeer off, and everybody had to see that exhibition, including me. The temperature was hot. The enthusiasm was really high. The temperature was really low, and I got into the gallery, and it was packed like sardines. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
I do. It was ridiculous. And these Vermeer paintings are small, and I remember jockeying for position in front of the works and amid these winter coats and scarves and hats, and all I saw were the backs of people's heads. It was like a free-for-all. I mean, there was a lot of very unimpressive ball spots. That's one thing I definitely remember. And the littler people squeezed ahead in the crowd and got in the frontier to Vermeer. And that's all I remember. It was a horrible experience. And I kind of got down on Vermeer because of that, believe it or not. And after seeing the girl with the red hat, that was that. I mean, I was out of there. So what about Vermeer, Sheila?
Well, it's not just me that thinks this, Tom, but Vermeer is one of the greatest painters of all time. It's Vermeer, Rembrandt, Da Vinci. In music, it's Bach, Beethoven, and, well, I asked my husband, Schnittke.
Schnittke?
Instead of Brahms. But after that, it's a matter of taste because they're the greatest. Personally, I'm a Bach Vermeer girl. There's probably nothing in original that I'm going to say about these greatness of his paintings, but I'm going to have to say it anyway.
I know you will. And well, this exhibition, fortunately, is not just about Vermeer. It also has the other heavies of Dutch genre painting at the time of Vermeer in the 1600s. This is why I titled the program, Can You Top This? Because you find other fabulous painters of the age like Gabriel Metsu, and Nicolaus Mace, Gerard de Bortsch, Gerard Dou, John Steen, Franz Vermeeris, and Pieter de Hooch. So they're another cast of the A-list of the genre painters. And these guys could paint. And in their own right, they followed with patronage, and they had students, and they were very well respected in their cities and also beyond Holland. Not so for Vermeer, though. He was very little known outside the city of Delft. The National Gallery puts them together in a thematic way, which works from the curatorial aspects and the consistency of wonderful painting, which is of the age. Our listeners need to be prepared to see a lot of other paintings, not just Vermeer. Our listeners and hopefully visitors to the exhibition need to be prepared for the crowds and the lines and the waits. So be prepared for that when you come out to see this great show. Seeing these works and contrasting them is really what we're proposing here for this show. I know that Sheila is chomping at the bit here about these contrasts of the artist. And Sheila, give us the impressions of all your works and not just Vermeer without hyperventilating. Give us a little information.
All right. I will. I have to start with what it's like when you walk into the exhibition. The lights are low, and when you walk in, no matter how small the Vermeers are, they just come right off the wall. They have a certain light and clarity and simplicity, and then there's all the other paintings. So there really are two different ways of looking at this exhibition. The first is the way it's intended. The fascination that art historians have of deciphering the influences these painters had on each other, which is, there's very little documentation. It all happened 350 years ago. And the fabulous sleuthing curators who put together this show had a wonderful time locating these paintings. The artists all lived in cities close to each other, and they could travel by horse, by cart, or by foot, and even visit, you know, a few of the artists' homes in the same day. Mm. And this whole genre movement took place within between 1620 and 1680. So it's really interesting to put it together. How did the artists get to see each other's works? Who saw what first? The exhibit is organized by theme because they all borrowed each other's themes. The same symbols, the same stories, stories about love letters and parrots and courtesans and the maids who knew everything that was going on. The dogs, there are a lot of dogs and symbols, music, science, drinking, and sleeping it off. The paintings are hung so you can make comparisons. The same garment will appear with different painters. You can do quite a bit of sleuthing yourself.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, but the second way is what's more important to me. How did they do it? How did they get this luminous quality? How did they get this space? How did they ever learn to paint Saturn and painting patterns and textured rugs. How did they learn to paint the most expressive hands? Every single one of them can paint hands so beautifully when Matisse pretty much blew hands off. What really makes these paintings great and what makes Vermeer rise above them all? This is what I'm going to concentrate on, because Vermeer is not only full of understated drama and meaning, he's also a painter's painter. I realized looking at the show how much Vermeer taught me how to see, to draw, because he understands perfectly the two-dimensional picture plane and the illusion of a three-dimensional space.
Yeah, fantastic.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's true.
I think when I was in high school, somebody told me that Vermeer was a great painter because you could look at a painting upside down and it would still be a good abstract composition. Of course, that idea went right by me. I didn't understand anything about abstraction, as I said before. But an obvious way that Vermeer is different from all the other painters is his way of illuminating every person and object so that they combine into shapes, making perfect compositions, so that the wall that would just be a fading into dark shadows with the other artists is just as an important part of the composition as the figures and the still lifes. I talk about this a lot, but the abstraction, the combined shapes into values, bring everything to life and light. It's what distinguishes Vermeer from all his brilliant but lesser friends. Metsu tries by lighting his walls, but he doesn't have the grasp of the power of the simplicity of the shapes. But it's much easier to pull things out of the shadows than to do what Vermeer did. The other painters care primarily about the story. Vermeer cared more about the atmosphere, the feeling, the mood, the vibe.
Oh, yeah, thank you for that, Sheila. That's absolutely true. Well, as we do in many of our shows, we need to define some terms that are addressed in the exhibition. Sheila, talk a little about genre painting in general.
Sure. Well, before genre painters were the history painters, and history painters depicted biblical, mythological, historic scenes. Artists like Rubens, Raphael, Michelangelo, Titian, you know, Tom, your Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Right.
But in the third quarter of the 17th century, the Dutch painters turned to a small, domestic, intimate scenes with hidden meanings. They often told half the story and let the viewer tell the rest. These paintings were mostly small. They were actually displayed in boxes, so that when the viewer opened the doors of the box, they were entering a small world with exquisite, intimate life. The Dutch artists were prolific, and there were many artists, but the ones in this show rose to the top. And then there's the camera lucida. Although the artist's methods are not discussed in this exhibit at all, they are surely of interest to me. It's known that Vermeer used a camera obscura, which is an instrument pretty much like a room-sized box camera. An image, a real view, or a portrait is projected through a lens, through a hole, into a darkened room, and the image is cast upside down onto the wall, facing the hole. The artist can, if he has great skill, trace the image onto a canvas. In the first Vermeer show, the one in 1995, they had a camera lucida set up so you could see how it worked. The artist, David Hockney, the British artist, wrote a convincing and controversial investigation into the use of lenses in the history of painting, which is called Hidden Secrets. It's like a wonderful book. And in the catalog to this show, it is mentioned and dismissed by explaining that the artist's vision had such humanity, such distinctive vision, that tools could not possibly have created that. It's such a limited view. The devices were difficult to use. The usable image isn't much more than a foot across. It wasn't possible to set up an entire room and trace it. That's ridiculous. The artist's vision is so personal. I mean, each of these artists. I mean, look at these paintings. They were hardly original, either in subject or of style, and yet each one is the individual of the vision of the artist, and that's what makes them the work of art. The images had to be combined, manipulated, but what made possible this incredible lifelikeness in expression, in pattern, texture, detail, and in perspective.
Yeah, I think that's the intensity of it. You have to go look at all those things in these little paintings. They're not big.
Oh, my God.
So you have to really get down and study.
Yeah. Well, a few years ago, an inventor named Tim Jennison, he was so driven to discover the mysteries of Vermeer's painting that he built an exact replica of Vermeer's studio in a warehouse in San Antonio. And he proceeded to make, with a camera obscura, an exact copy of Vermeer's music lesson. It was painstaking. The final result is not really shown in the film. But in making this, he found several anomalies that appear in the original painting and that can be explained by using this method.
Well, one of the things about the exhibit, Sheila, is these colors, you know, these amazing, you know, pigments and paints that they use. That you don't see those colors anymore, hardly.
No.
So that, to me, is something that you really enjoy.
I love this. Well, you know, there were much fewer pigments than, like, the cadmiums weren't invented yet. I mean, there were a lot fewer pigments, and they were very valuable. There were 16 colors available to Vermeer. And they had different drying times and different coverage. And Vermeer used a specifically refined palette of red, yellow, and blue. If natural ultramarine blue could be considered the king of Vermeer's palette, yellow could be called the queen. This particular yellow had several different names in the past, but it's now commonly called lead tin yellow.
And it is beautiful.
It's a beautiful,
and he uses it amazingly.
Wow. So these artists lived in a time of prosperity, and the artists also often had assistants to grind their own pigments into oil. The way the pigments were ground was of great concern. They left microscopic particles that were uneven to create the most luminescence, and the paints had to be ground each day so they wouldn't be wasted. Specific colors of the age, like lapis lazuli blue, which is like our ultramarine blue, lead white and lead tin yellow, we don't have that. And red matters and crimson lakes and the red from the cochineal insect were expensive pigments. And so in order to economize, artists had to learn first to model form in tones, in monochrome, under painting, from white to black. And then they added the color, both glazed and opaque, so they could save on changes in the painting. Oftentimes when they photograph the painting, they can see whole figures that were painted out, especially with Vermeer, for simplicity. And metal tubes, they were only invented in the mid-19th century. So imagine how that made plein air painting possible. And now there's clear evidence that some colors have faded, although it's a testimony to their careful preparation that the painting stays strong in spite of it.
Yes, and I think it's our listeners should really go see the show in the sense of just to look at these specific colors and how they use them and how they model the figures. Well, that was one of the wonderful aspects of the movie Girl with a Pearl Earring many years ago, which was on Vermeer with a host of fabulous actors and actresses. And the movie conveyed Vermeer's process and the grinding of his paints very well. And it was an arduous process as well. Well, something about the illusions that you see in a lot of these Dutch paintings bring up, of course, the camera obscura, the camera lucida, and how they created interesting spatial effects depending on the lens and how the objects in space were positioned. The depth of field, as we know from using a camera, was altered in an odd way, and sometimes there were these forced perspectives, which created aspects of the composition that seemed compressed and slightly tilted at times. That's interesting when you look into these rooms. Something is kind of compressed. That's something to look out for. And then, of course, there are these value contrasts. Depending on each artist and their style, certain works were very contrasty in the lights and the darks and in the canvas. And Vermeer had a tendency to make things less distinct on the edge, and they appeared slightly fuzzy, and they were less crisp. So that was something about Vermeer that gave him that moodiness to his paintings. And then there was Nicholas Mays, who was much more into these contrasts and defined crisp edges. I'd like to define a word which you don't hear much anymore, and that's tenebrism. Tenebrism is a word that deals with value contrasts in a value situation in a painting where the dark darks are right next to the light lights. And you see this in the 15th century with Caravaggio and the French painter Georges Latour, and you see this in a lot of these candle-lit paintings in the exhibition. They're very beautiful. You know, you get the yellow glow of the candle next to this really rich, dark, umbery, not even black, like a blue-black. So that's interesting in some of these paintings. The historical significance of these works via commerce, economics, and politics of the age are very evident. And many of these artists were really riding high in the times because of this rich history and of Dutch traditions. Historical, biblical works were not as popular in the time of Vermeer, but we also get Vermeer that gives a sense of moral and ethical judgment in some Christian themes. As I learned in my research that he was a converted Catholic, I was really shocked about that, that Vermeer had changed his religion to Catholicism, and there are some moral issues in his work. Art historians believe that he was a man with many religious convictions. I think it's important to talk a little here about the patronage and what was hot and what was not at the times. The Netherlands were an important player on the international stage in the European colonial period. Remember, most of Lower New York City was founded by the Dutch, and, you know, I'm from that part of the world, and so are you, actually. But they also were in the West Indies and Africa and Asia. The Dutch were a force of mercantile commerce, and lots of money was around with the Dutch, and they knew about how to use it. And the patronage of the artists were there. There was industry in ceramics, tapestry, breweries, boat building. Money was going in and out, and the artists were on that wave. Additionally, things were coming out of Holland, like were coming into Holland, like Oriental carpets, spices, exotic animals, which we talked about in another show. And there was a lot of foreign goods, so there was a lot of things percolating in Holland at the time. Well, one of the things that I wanted to just mention is that in the exhibition, you see a lot of Turkish and Persian carpets in these Dutch paintings. And I could spend a whole show on this, Gila, but I'm just going to talk. I'm just going to talk a little about the fact that the history of the Oriental carpet would not have been clear if it wasn't for these paintings, because the paintings preserved the carpet imagery, which the carpets didn't survive, right, because of being worn, being stepped on, and all this. So Dutch painting is important in the history of textiles, because the paintings preserved a kind of carpet that could be identified through the history of their Dutch paintings. So it's, I think that was very
brilliant
important
of you.
That's wow. That was really something that I got excited about, because you saw so many Oriental carpets on these tables. Remember, they weren't on the floor.
Right.
For the most part, they were just sitting on a table. So let's continue a little about what was happening in Holland at the time, Sheila.
Okay. Well, the Dutch painters worked right alongside of the inventor of the microscope, Leeuwenhoek. And the geographers were charting maps. There was a lot of exploration and included these subjects in their paintings. But there's still a skepticism about the use of optical lenses. People, it's not cheating. The lenses had their own limitations. But it would be possible to project a portrait-sized person sitting in a bright sunlight in another outside in the bright sunlight onto a paper in a darkened room. And in fact, portraits from the 15th to 19th century have convincing evidence of that. The portraits of Gerrit Dou and Frans de Mieris are set up as though the subject is in a window. Oftentimes it's like an arched window or there's a window sill, but projecting a whole room, an artist would have to have great skill to manipulate those images into a whole scene. And this was a terrific time for advancing science and art. And, you know, we always say they go hand in hand, very much as our age of technology is making what was impossible possible. Vermeer often softened the edges of his shapes. Tom just mentioned that. And what he did was he painted wet onto wet paint. And he kept the foreground out of focus, whereas like Harold de Bosch kept his edges sharp. I don't see any reason that all these painters, given the lifelikeness of their vision, wouldn't have availed themselves of any tools they could. Of course they would. There was such a high level of achievement in all these artists, and there were so many other less visionary painters that these were the ones, these artists rose to the top, and there was an intense competition for patrons.
Yeah, I know. This is definitely the A-list for the Dutch paintings here in Washington right now. Well, I'd like to address something that struck me in the exhibition was all about these compositional and what the compositions of the paintings were made out of. And there was a lot of convention. Firstly, I want to mention that these paintings are not large. They're on the small side to medium to small size. And conventionally, they were also small at the time. They didn't paint very large paintings. They're not miniature, but they're a step above some of them. And the key word here is the word convention, because these works seem to be composed in a kind of a recipe or a script within the Dutch tradition. Now, Vermeer is actually one that seems to have milked it, this convention, with a good compositional recipe with most of his paintings. And again, Vermeer is pretty predictable. I mean, Sheila, I've got to tell you, he's got the table on one side, the figure on another, the window is always on the left for the most part. You know, he has these conventions. But the other artists were doing it just the same. It was like a kind of little copycat thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
And many of these works in the exhibition have all the action happening in the canvas at the bottom. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that you see in European paintings at the time also. Meaning about a third of the painting at the top really was nothing but dark, dreary colors. Mm-hmm. And everything else was towards the middle and the bottom. Very much part of the European tradition in general. And you see a cooler backgrounds for the most part, you know, with purples and blues and greenish, cool greens. And then in the foregrounds, you see these warmer reds and earth tones that are kind of warm. So there are these compositional conventions all over the place. And being that these paintings are very gravity-based, a lot of heaviness is at the bottom visually. And the scales of the figures are somewhat similar in all of them as well, except for Vermeer.
Except for Vermeer, who often puts the figure really right. You know, you enter the painting almost through the figure.
Oh, that's absolutely really beautiful. Right. And that's where Vermeer shines in breaking some of these conventions. Mm-hmm. The chairs, the curtains, the carpets, the tables with things on them, the windows on the left side, the backgrounds of arm are pretty much similar. And as we just mentioned, Vermeer breaks from that pack. Vermeer figures are much more important. He simplifies and abstracts things while the others don't. The others got to get every little nitty-gritty detail in there. Vermeer skips over the details and simplifies things in a more human space. Vermeer's works are less busy and incredibly more inviting. Yet they have that mystery, which the others have, but Vermeer's is a different kind of mystery. It's much more open, I think. His color range is much smaller, and his tones are muted and neutralized, except for those lovely blues, those pale yellows, those rusts, those vermilion reds, and oranges red. And that's where Vermeer just runs from the pack. It's time to take a little station break. We have a really fun song about Vermeer here. So let's listen up.
Smell of joy and sweat. Some paintings plain look so fine. Some paintings are sad and passionate, but Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Yeah, Vermeer sends a chill up your spine. Vermeer was eerie, Vermeer was strange. He had a more modern color range. as if born in another age, like maybe 100 or so years ago. What's this, a ghost in the gallery? Great Scott, the Martians are here. These strange little paintings next to the others, no one was like Vermeer. Vermeer was eerie, Vermeer was weird. He had his own way of doing things with the paintings from another era, another era.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM.
Well, let's talk a little about these genres that were categorized in the show, Sheila.
Sure. Well, there's music. That's a big one. And there are the most beautiful depictions of musical duos that are set. They're all in luxurious interiors. They have carpets, tapestries, upholstered chairs, keyboard instruments, the clavichord, the virginal, the harpsichord. I can't tell the difference.
Yeah, really?
And they're beautiful. They're ornately decorated. And there's a duet, like the Vermeer's young woman seated at the virginal. The instruments have beautiful shapes. And the tour de force of having positioned these string instruments, a guitar, a viola da gamba, in Du's Woman at the Clavichord in perfect perspective. That's been speculated on. There is a woodcut from Dürer from 1525 that shows how a contraption that requires two people using strings and sight lines that could meticulously draw a lute in perspective.
Amazing.
Yes, it is, because, and that's what kind of a problem it produced. And these instruments are all drawn perfectly.
Yeah, that's all stuff.
And then there's another category is lace making, and letter writing is a very big one, and the written arts. And then the position of men in society, in prosperity and everyday life. There's some of them are obviously low life. A lot of them are sleeping or drinking.
Hey, what's wrong with low life?
And some of them are very obviously very courtly. And then there's love and courtship. That's another theme. And then there's parrots and with lavish interiors. So there's a lot of lot of overlap, too, in these.
It was scenes. Very different. I hadn't seen a show like that in a while. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the way they categorized these genres, the way the artists connected were connected by the genre, the musical instruments, the letter writing, reading, the drunkenness at the parties, the whores and their potential customers. And this was all part of Dutch life at the time. All the painters in the exhibition were masters. I think that's true, Sheila. They really were. And their virtuosity was amazing, and how they used the paint was amazing, the technical aspects of illusion, the aesthetics and the layering of the paint. And they were all accomplished really well. We don't have time to talk about every of the artists in the exhibit, but let's really run by through the quick A-list here. Mm-hmm. The first one is Gerard de Burch, and he was a fantastic and influential painter at the time. He was turning away from historic and biblical work and making his works more contemporary or modern about everyday life in Holland. He was popular in Amsterdam and Harlem, and he had quite a following. And his works imbue an intimacy and a sensitivity echoed by his brushwork and his earthy tones. And there's a lot of humanity in his work. And he had a little of a relationship with Vermeer. Of all the artists in the show, he's the one that only had a little relationship. There really wasn't anybody else that was connected with Vermeer. And there was Jared Du, who was fantastic. And the National Gallery had an exhibit on his work a few years ago. And he was a student of Rembrandt from Leiden, and he had a flair for commissions, and he was in the money pipeline with lots of portraits of wealthy people and academics, and they were very small-scale paintings for the most part. They almost come out of a tempera painting legacy. I don't know if you saw that. I mean, there was something about the layering of the tones. His brushwork was a lot finer than Debord's, for sure. And he was very well connected, and I think he's nicely represented in the exhibition. An artist that I did not know about and I learned about, which I found his work very nice, was Franz van Mieris. And he was represented as a student of Jared Du, so there was a connection there with Du. And his work in the exhibition, and this in the second room with this woman playing a Theobo lute from 1663. Sheila, that was a knockout painting with this golden satin dress and the way that the lute was painted. I mean, that really requires attention in the exhibition. It's in the second room. And there's also another painting about drinking buddies that hung out together. That was quite nice. And I mean, there was a lot of other great paintings. This Gabriel Metsu was another one with very different non-conventional stuff of the time. He had a kind of a wider color range and a brighter range, and he used conventions that were a little similar in some way, but a little more tender. And there was a lot of movement and rhythm in the works. And his work, A Woman Reading a Letter, which I thought was one of the best paintings in the show, really wonderful. And lastly, I'd like to talk about Pieter de Hooch. Pieter de Hooch was a great painter, and I knew about him actually in high school, as we had a print in our home of Pieter de Hooch. I don't know when my father got it, but he said somebody gave it to him. I don't know how true that was, but anyway, it's a Dutch courtyard, and it mesmerized our family how somebody could paint bricks and pavement. And Pieter de Hooch was really good at that. There's a few paintings in the show, which we'll talk about one of them later, and he kind of rivals Vermeer in some ways, in a different sense, and they were both working at Delft at the same time, so they were kind of contemporaries, and also they were in competition. And in the exhibition, the interior with a woman weighing a gold coin, I think, is one of the standouts in the exhibition.
Yeah, you did love that, yes.
And, you know, it rivals Vermeer's A Woman with a Balance, and there's a lot to compare later on this. So we'll talk about some of these things later. Let's get back to the exhibition, Sheila, and talk about that lace making.
Well, that lace making, the painting, it's a little jewel. It's about 9 inches by 8 inches. And the woman has her face in shadow, and she's looking down at her work, and you can see pins and cloth and tiny threads. But what you really see is her concentration. And as a viewer, you are drawn in to concentrate on the painting in the same way that she is concentrating on her work.
That's wonderful.
The painting is really divided into two basic shapes, and the combined shape of the figure, the furniture, and the wall. And the figure in the furniture, and then the wall is the other shape. The thing Vermeer does is to hide things in the shadows, but still illuminate them just enough so that you can peer into them and see the texture and the pattern. It's not quite hidden. I think that's part of the mysterious vision. In the paintings of the other masters, which depend for their drama on light and shadow, you're just kind of cut out of the dark. Nothing here to see, folks.
You know, it's so interesting to contrast that in the same room is the painting Young Woman Making Lace by Nicholas Mayes. And it's so different. It's heavy. It's dark and it's somewhat boring. It's almost amateurish, I hate to say it. The spatial relationship is distant and there's no sense of intimacy. Like she's there, she's staring at her lace, but you're not involved with her. You're almost like voyeur looking at her. You kind of get into the space with the Vermeer, with the lace maker. And I think that's an interesting contrast, and the exhibition allows you to see these contrasts. What about some of the music now again?
Well, there are many paintings of music, and in the first six paintings of the musical duos, except for the Vermeer, the men are too noisy. They're about to be given liquid refreshments. A large instrument is about to become too noisy. But in the second three, which was inviting duets, each of these paintings is set up for a genteel kind of love. The women at the harpsichord, who are caught by the viewer, who's interrupting her, about to accompany her on the viola da gamba, which is propped up and waiting. It's a great device welcoming the viewer to join her. These instruments are so carefully chosen, not only for what they convey, leisure, grace, flirtation, come in and take part in beauty, but they're also such beautiful and difficult objects to paint. In the young woman seated at the Virginal, which is a Vermeer painting, the open top of the instrument has a painting of a landscape by a Delft painter, and it opens up the idea of faraway places. Or in the woman with a lute, there's a map on the wall behind her. The Van Barbaren painting of Procurus on the rear wall is a lustful scene, and it's contrasted with the genteel but erotically charged middle-class world that Vermeer's women occupy.
And there's a lot going on in those Vermeer paintings.
Oh, my God. You have to check out every single thing. Everything on the wall, on the table, it all has meaning.
Yeah, it's a mystery into a mystery into a mystery. Well, we talked a little before about Franz von Mises's mesmerizing little painting, The Woman Playing a Theobald Lute. And once again, he has the virtuosity. He paints this incredibly pale golden satin, which is mind-blowing, not to mention the instrument. So you really need to study that painting as well, because the hands are so tiny in that almost miniature, but yet they're really expressive. And I think that's one of the great things. The virtuosity of the paint and the brushwork are really evident, and the surface of the panel and the richly modeled textures and patterns and the folds and all these paintings with the musical instruments is really amazing. Not to mention, you got to check out the hair. The way they did that hair, it's like, I mean, these people are using some really good shampoo because it was shining like nobody's business. My hand never looked that shiny. Anyway, many of these pairings had this curtain in the foreground, which was another convention, and it kind of unveils the performance behind it, which is somebody playing an instrument. So it's a performance. It's a entree to an entree to an entree. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things about it's a performance piece and kind of stop action. And you get a sense of the magic of the space as you go into another space. So that was very exciting. Yeah.
And another theme is letter writing. And I think that at least the curators of the show all agree that any letter being written is a love letter. So in Jan Vermeer's later Lady Writing a Letter in 1665, it's incredibly still. The only sign of activity is a crumpled letter on the floor with a wax seal, so that you don't know if this letter is a second try at the letter because it wasn't successful the first time, or it was angrily thrown down. You don't know why there's another letter there. Or maybe it's the letter that was received, and she was furious with that,
She was writing back fast.
So, and the maid is sort of distractedly looking out the window. Maybe she's seen all this before. And the garments are minimally interesting, so most of the action in the painting is on the wall above, which is of finding Moses in the bulrushes. And that same painting is reduced in another Vermeer of The Astronomer.
Yes, it's again, there's repetitive things going on in these paintings in the show. Well, there was a Gera Tiborch, a woman writing a letter by candlelight from 1670. That's a really tiny painting, but it has a great sensuality and almost sexual intimacy. There's a gorgeous flame that's really warms up the canvas with these neutral tones around her. This is one of the examples of tenebrism that I spoke about in our definitions. It's a very bright next to a dark, and it adds great mystery and mood and great color and contrast. That's a sweet little gem, that painting.
Yeah. And the difference between the light coming through the window or the candlelight, it's like a completely different light.
Oh, feeling, oh, yeah, boy. For sure.
So the Vermeer's Astronomer is really an important work in this exhibit. And when you walk into the room, there are two. There's the astronomer and the geographer. And I'm telling you, I love these paintings so much. They're the two paintings that have men as their subjects. All of these genre paintings have women as the primary subject. And the model was thought maybe to be Anthony van Leeuwenhoek, who invented the microscope. And he was a neighbor of Vermeer. And they could have collaborated some because he would, polish these lenses.
Yeah.
And he was a real, really great inventor. So there's a lot of speculation because there's no paper trail. Mm. But at one point, von Leeuwenhoek's instruments were made available for public viewing. And certainly Vermeer and Du, who also did a fabulous painting of a scientist, they would have seen these instruments.
Yeah, and yeah. I actually like to talk about that, Gerard Du's Astronomer by Candlelight, which is so different from Vermeer's. And Du is more of a traditional painter in some ways, and he sticks to those conventions. But then he has these extreme value contrasts for mood and somewhat clarity. And the scale of the details of the work is mesmerizing. He doesn't push the envelope like Vermeer, but he is virtuous in many other ways. And Sheila, why don't we let's get down to the drunkenness?
Yeah.
Why don't we just talk about drunkenness?
Well,
let's do
it because I feel like we've been so serious. So these are very popular themes: drinking, debauchery, and sleeping it off. And they're also funny.
A
lot of them are almost like hilarious cartoons of what happens when you drink too much. There are five paintings. Three are by Harold de Bosch, and there's one by Frans de Muris and Jacob Oosterveld. And those are in brothels. Women are plying men with drink. You can see them just practically pouring it down their throats. And a woman is making fun of a sleeping soldier, and a man is blowing smoke at him from behind. What can we do with this guy?
Taunting
now that
him.
He's totally out of it. And these painters are borrowing from each other's stories and paying homage to each other. It's different than in the Italian Renaissance, where people would keep their secrets. They had their own technical secrets, but they so openly borrowed themes from one another.
Yeah. There was much more like a kind of a gang mentality in the painting. And then, you know, that Sleeping Soldier by Gera Tiborch, it hit me in a kind of a bad way, because it's kind of the convention again in a bad way, in a very weak composition. Mm. It's really nicely painted, but like a third of the canvas is empty at the green-gray top, and there's nothing going on. All the action is gravity-based at the bottom, and it's heavy on the darks. And I think the composition is really terrible, but, you know, it's not Vermeer, and who uses the entire thing elegantly. Well, there's a one wall in the gallery in this exhibition that I think had two really gorgeous works of a medium size by Gabriel Metsu. This is a woman reading a letter and a man writing a letter. And these works were implying courtship, and they reference each other in many ways. They are light and airy, and it's such a departure from the other dark Dutch genre paintings. And it's in the vicinity by another Metsu work, Man Visiting a Woman Washing Her Hand. It's such a rich combination of colors and spaces. Sheila, that orange, vermilion, red that you see that these Dutch painters used is absolutely striking next to that rich gold. And how these guys painted textures of wood, metals, glass, and shines of all kinds of objects. They had to use a camera or something. They were looking really intensely at that because I think the camera would pick up those details better than the human eye.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, after I was looking at these paintings, I went to the paint store and I bought myself three different reds that I don't have. And I could not get that vermilion.
I don't think they even make it anymore.
No. Oh, my God.
Yeah, no,
no,
it's impossible. So Metsu proves himself in this show to be a really great painter.
That paint, the painting of woman reading a letter, it's got such lovely color sequences, and it's unusually bright and pleasing, and also has a tremendous amount of activity. The laundry basket, the maid with a pail, and she's drawing the curtain back on a seascape outside. And maybe it's a reminder of the writer of the letter who's at sea, but why is the woman sitting on a wooden stand? It's like a model stand. It looks like it's made out of plywood. Just like she has to step on this stand to read her letters.
It brought it to a higher level.
Good.
Well, there's a lot of courtship going on in the exhibition, and you know, not only the art, but also the spectators in the gallery and the paintings. It was very interesting. But, you know, only in this exhibition with Vermeer, who, you know, he's kind of sexy. He talks a lot about sex in these paintings. And did I really say that about Vermeer? Is that okay, Sheila, to say that about Vermeer? He's really about sex, isn't he?
Right ahead. Yeah, he also had 12 children.
Oh, I forgot about that little fact.
So is there a single Vermeer that isn't about courtship, except for the scientists? So many of these paintings have described either a suitor who's drunk or sober or evidence of a suitor in a letter. But the milkmaid is one of my favorite paintings. And that milkmaid is more of a protector. She's sturdy. She's pouring the milk. There's the very little drama. The only drama is she's pouring milk. And the still life on the table is just the finest. The dabs of thick, opaque paint, which really suggest the topography of the bread and the stoneware and the basket. And they just flicker off in this way that could really certainly suggest that the artist used a camera obscura as an aid. Because how else would you even know to get
exactly
that image?
These little like details. Well, one of the great works in the show is by an artist that I'd never heard of, Samuel von Hoogstraten, and it's called A View of an Interior. I think it's the only work in the show that doesn't have a figure in it. It's just an interior. There are no people. And I thought it was great because it's a space looking into a space looking into a space. I think this concept comes out of some theological basis of the Protestant Reformation, but it's like kind of the steps to the ladder of heaven. And I think you kind of go into a light. It starts dark and it gets lighter and lighter and lighter as you go into the next space. So I found those very, very interesting. From foreground to background. And again, every little niche in these spaces had, you know, pieces of everyday life. And the exhibition ends, Sheila, with a knockout, Woman Holding a Balance by Vermeer. And, you know, this is kind of an exhibit that was kind of dragging on, but then you come to that great painting, and I know you just went bubbly on it.
Yeah, well, there's a sense of anticipation in all of Vermeer's paintings, and it's a pleasant anticipation. A young woman putting on her pearls, or the woman seated at the virginal, and soon someone's going to join her. And it's such an optimistic and genteel time. Even the woman holding the balance is pregnant. She's expectant. The last painting in the exhibition is of Vermeer, a woman seated at the virginal, and it's dated 1671 to 74. And although in 1672, Holland was invaded by the French. The Franco-Dutch War lasted 4 years, and that time of prosperity was over. So Vermeer died in debt, and his paintings sank into obscurity until they were discovered after almost two centuries.
Well, Vermeer and the Masters of Genre Painting will not disappoint you. Vermeer brings in crowds anytime, anywhere, and in as in 1995 and 96, as we'd mentioned. But expect to be in line and waiting should you get there in the middle of the day, on the weekends especially, and during the holiday season. But we do suggest you get there just as the museum opens on a weekday if you can. It's the best time to see this show. Seeing these small-scale works in the exhibition with these large throngs of people can be frustrating. Bring your patience and a keen eye, and you will be really hosted to a treat of great Dutch genre painting. There's virtuosity and brilliance in every way in this exhibition. The exhibition is free, of course, no charge. It's a national gallery, and you'll be very satisfied. Any art enthusiast will learn about history, new artists they're not familiar with, and of course, Vermeer and his poetry of painting. Sheila, tell us a little about upcoming shows.
Well, Tom, we've been working on a busy schedule, and we have the calendar worked out for lots of visual variety. We will venture into the world of Latin American art and what is here locally in that scene. In an upcoming show, we also want to address feminism in art and great women artists who had to be in the shadow of their more famous artist husbands. That's some bad stuff.
You got that right. We got to set the record straight on that show. And we'll also talk about some politics in the future, because you know it's heating up here in D.C. by the second. And so we'd like for you to stay tuned, because we got a lot of exciting things by the second coming up here at WOWDLP Tacoma Park. We have Bobby Hill coming up next, and he's going to give you a great show with this music, avant-garde jazz. And stay tuned and keep that dial fixed, because Bobby's going to really give you his jazzy vibe in this afternoon. And we also have Bobby on Wednesdays mornings from 10 a.m. to noon with No Border, No Lines, with great musical variety. We invite you for next Sunday between 8 and 10, our friend Gail Barron's The Night Ride Home. Gail serves up an eclectic and selective mix of songs and hosts of musical genres. We invite you to go to our website, tacomaradio.org, and look at our program schedule for the week. We want to thank you very, very much. Have a great afternoon. And until next time, see art in everything you do. Experience the visual. Have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.